Good evening. Welcome. We're very glad to have you here this evening for our C. Henry Smith competition. I'm Nancy Heise, and I'm a member of the Bible and Religion faculty here at EMU. Our department, together with the Department of Applied Social Sciences and the Language and Literature Department, host this contest every year. So I'd like to thank our committee, Vi Dutcher, who's director of the writing program, Gloria Rhodes, chair of Department of Applied Social Sciences, and Sherry Smucker, our ABLE assistant. The Smith Contest was established in 1974 by the directors of the C. Henry Smith Trust as a way of honoring the Mennonite historian who taught at Goshen College and Bluffton University. Smith is well known for his numerous books on Mennonite history and his particular attention to the peace commitments of the Mennonite tradition. This contest is annually administered by the Peace and Justice Ministries of Mennonite Central Committee. Students from every Mennonite and Brethren in Christ College are eligible to participate. Here at EMU, we have participated in the contest since 2003, and EMU students have won the grand prize in 2003, 2004, 2007, 2009, and 2011, and EMU students have also placed in more recent years. I'd like to especially thank our judges for this year's event. They are James Richardson, who is assistant professor in our music department, and he is serving as the convener of the judges. As noted from his title, he is also a well-known baritone, and he is widely in demand as a concert performer. He has a long experience in judging and has served in the past, and tonight is serving as our convener of the judges. Andrea Dalton Sainer, assistant professor of Hebrew language and Old Testament, the first faculty member to hold a joint appointment from both Eastern Mennonite Seminary and the Bible and Religion Department. She regularly bikes to work, is writing a commentary on Exodus, and has an absolutely adorable, almost two-year-old named Henry. Maybe he's two by now. And Tim Seidel, who is instructor in political studies, teaches development and peace building in the Department of Applied Social Sciences and CJP. And he just told me tonight that when he worked at Mennonite Central Committee, he was actually the one who was in charge of seeing that this contest happened. So he knows all about it. Tim has also worked for many years as a peace development worker in Palestine, Israel, as well as serving with MCC in the Peace and Justice Ministries in the United States. So let's thank our judges. We have seven contestants this year, and they have each prepared a speech that applies the Christian peace position to a contemporary concern. They've drawn numbers and will proceed in this order. If you have your program, you can quickly note the number. Number one is Molly White. Number two, Diego Barjona. Number three, Kat Lehman. Number four, Hannah Mack-Bull. Number five, Lydia Haggard. Number six, Grantley Showalter. And number seven, Joel Wheeler. After each speech, we'll give the judges time to record their notes and comments, and during this period there will be some refreshments made available to us by the Student Government Association, so thanks to you, SGA. When the judges are ready, we will begin again. The door will be closed when the speakers are speaking, so if you're coming in and out, Gloria's the bouncer. When she tells you no, you wait till the next one. Welcome very much to all of you. We're glad you're here. This is a wonderful evening, and we're going to begin. Our first speaker is Molly White. Molly's title is Ruth's Activism: Christianity, Identity, and Justice.
Good evening. Once there was a woman whose husband decided they needed to move to another country. This woman packed up their house and went with her husband and sons. While there, her sons married two women. Then, her husband and sons died. The woman decided to go back to her home country. Once, there was a daughter who loved her mother-in-law so much she wanted to travel with her. Her mother-in-law warned her that the road would be tough and they would be penniless. The daughter said she didn't care. She would go with her mother-in-law and live in her homeland. Once, there were two women who made an oath to support and be community for each other. The mother's name was Naomi, and the daughter's Ruth. Ruth's story is an intersectional one. Intersectionality is a way of seeing that recognizes the multiple aspects of our identity that enrich our lives and experiences, and that compound and complicate the different ways people are pushed to the outskirts of society. A lack of intersectionality leads to an erasure of people and their identities. But when we see these multiple identities, we are truly Christ-like. Jesus addressed throughout his ministry specific political, social, and racial issues of his day, even though he held a large amount of privilege in the Jewish society. As a Jewish man, he went out of his way to listen and teach women, bring Samaritans who were seen as unworthy into the fold, and heal those seen unclean. Jesus used his privilege to change his society and heard the voices of those less privileged throughout his ministry. In Matthew 5:6, Jesus says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled." However, the Greek word for righteousness can also be translated as justice. Jesus is calling us to strive for justice for all people. I am a white, straight, Christian American woman. The majority of my identities have privilege. We all deal with privilege in our lives. But as white women, we don't always see it. We see the way we are disenfranchised, but not the way the system benefits us. But when we are working for peace and justice, we must first see how the system benefits us. Our movements cannot be truly anti-oppressive without an intersectional lens. This idea of identity was a recurring theme on my cross-cultural. When I was in Mexico, we met three women that had come to the U.S. without documentation and, for different reasons, were stuck on the Mexican side of the border, away from their families. One woman, who I will call Maria, explained how her daughter, Sarah, was still living in the States, but that Sarah was with her father, who was an abusive man. Maria had left Sarah because her mother was sick and dying in Mexico. She needed to see her mother one last time. When Maria tried to return to the U.S., she was deported to the Mexican side of the border with no way to get back to her daughter. She had lived in the U.S. for over 10 years, but unlike me, Maria was unable to move freely between the two countries. Her identities as immigrant, Mexican, mother, and daughter were all factors in her story. She reminded me of Ruth. Ruth is one of the two women in the Bible who get their own book. This is amazing for the 10th century BC, as women were not respected or valued. Yet her story seems to be one of great importance. What is even more interesting is that she is a Moabite. Moabites were considered inferior and not worthy of a place with the Israelites. She also carries the identity of immigrant and widow with her. Her story is so powerful because of her multiple identities. All of them are disenfranchised, and yet her story doesn't work without all of those identities. Like the woman in Mexico, she travels to be with a mother. Her people are seen as unimportant by the dominating group, and she is an immigrant. These identities shape her story, and focusing on one identity lessens the power of community the story portrays through all of her identities. Like looking at Ruth's stories, when we look at women's issues, we don't always see the whole picture unless we look at situations through an intersectional lens. For example, many of us know that women make 78 cents to every dollar a man makes. But this isn't true. According to the American Association of University Women, white, able-bodied women make 78 cents on a man's daughter. Hispanic women make 54 cents. African-American women make 63 cents. Women with disabilities make 65 cents, and transgendered women are paid almost a third less after they transition. If we look at this without an intersectional lens, we can't see the whole story. Jesus tells us to hunger and thirst for justice, but how can we when we only focus on one part of the injustice? To see the whole picture, we must see where the identities connect. So what do we do? This was a recurring question on my cross-cultural. When we were confronted with our privilege as white Americans, we always wanted to know what to do. How do we practice justice in anti-oppressive, intersectional ways? Ruth gives us the answer in her story. In chapter 1, she follows Naomi home to Bethlehem, even after Naomi has told her to go back to her family. Ruth follows Naomi and says this as an explanation. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There will I be buried. Ruth makes an oath, woman to woman, for support and community. We, as women of privilege, must do the same. We must take an oath to go with our sisters, hear their stories, confront our privilege, and fight for a more just world. Today, I take the oath of Ruth and try to live up to the bravery of a woman who left her home and identity. She traveled to a place that saw her as inferior because of her identities and still walked with Naomi. I promise to look at my own privilege and confront how it affects my worldview. I promise to listen for the voices of my Black, Hispanic, immigrant, trans, and disabled sisters and hear their stories. I promise to put myself in spaces where my identities aren't the majority and asking questions of those who don't have the same advantages I do. I promise to work with them to build a movement that sees identities through an intersectional way. This won't fix everything. It can't. But as the philosopher Cornel West said, none of us alone can save the nation or the world, but each of us can make a positive difference if we commit ourselves to do so. Let us make a positive difference by hungering for justice in the women's movement through intersectionality. I would like to finish with a poem written by Martin Niemöller in 1946 after the fall of Nazi Germany. This poem defines for me what it means to be an activist and stresses why it's important to fight for issues that don't, at first glance, seem to affect us. First, they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. We must all stand up against the injustice in our world, not just when we are affected, but wherever it is present. Thank you.
Our second speaker is Diego Barahona, and his speech is titled, Todo la sobra de lo que se llevaron, what was left over from what they took.
I remember the very first banana I ever ate inside the United States. Now, most of us wouldn't really consider this rather mundane fruit such a delectable culinary delicacy, but to that four-year-old me, that golden, crescent-shaped banana was probably as tantalizing as the forbidden fruit was for Eve in the garden. My parents and I were visiting the United States. We're from Honduras, and we're enjoying all the novelties that Orlando, Florida had to offer. You know, the theme roller coaster parks, the fairy tale castles with their respective Disney princesses, even these little pizzas in the shape of Mickey Mouse's head, among other US American classics. But what really caught my attention were not these things. What really and powerfully struck me was this banana. Now, most of you have probably seen a banana, perhaps one just like this. With its perfectly uniform, sunshine yellow skin emerging boldly from a sturdy, silky stem and ending in a perfectly geometric star-shaped point, this banana was probably smoother than my own preschooler skin. However, it's not this mathematical flawlessness that really caught my attention. What really surprised me was a small sticker sitting there inconspicuously on one of its sides with a barely readable inscription that said, Honduras. Now, this awestruck me. I had lived in the Banana Republic for 4 years and I had never seen anything like this. The ones that we ate came in slightly shriveled, brown speckled casings that, to be honest, weren't too appetizing unless you carefully peel them and cut them up into pieces. But these bananas, these magnificent fruit of the gods, these look like they could spit out our tiny Honduran bananas any day. Although, to be quite honest, I don't actually remember what they tasted like. But one thing was for sure, these were different. These were the ones that made it to the United States of America. Only the flawless, only the perfect, only those make it to the United States through all the cargo ships here. Similarly, only the brilliant, only the hardworking, only those willing to sacrifice their ancestral homeland and come here, only those make it to this country. The speckled, the slightly shriveled, the not quite so hardworking, not quite so qualified, those rarely find a place in this country built by immigrants, elite immigrants. During his presidential campaign, the current U.S. president mentioned that when Mexico and other Latin American countries send their people, they're not sending their best. But look around you. The immigrants that come here to actually settle and give their children a better place to live, the ones that are willing to sacrifice all they know, the ones that are willing to sacrifice so much to work even two or three jobs, to suffer abuses, to fight wars and die for their newly found home, those are the ones that truly make it here. Imagine if you were to take the best people from every single country in the world and conglomerate into one single nation state. Now, wouldn't that be the best country in the world? And that, my friends, has been the United States' secret. Attract the best people from all over and build a nation out of them. Bravo, you've made it. No wonder this country has been so prosperous for so long. But then what about us, the ones left behind? How will we build our country when 15% of our population lives in the United States with little to no plans of ever coming back? With whom will we build our civilization if our trained professionals take the very first opportunity they get to leave the country and our hardworking working class citizens pay for these opportunities atop a United States-bound train? Por guardar ese emblema divino marcharemos, o patria la muerte, wrote Augusto Cecuello, the author of our national anthem. In English, this translates roughly to safeguard your divine emblem, we will march, O homeland, to death. I wonder if the author ever thought that the only place we would be marching to would be away from our homeland, to emblematically escape our deaths. And of course, I'm not saying that all the people that stay behind are bad. The ones who stay in Honduras are certainly some good and honest people. Those with means, those with courage, those with an immense love for their country, those stay back and try, sacrificing theirs and their children's well-being, life expectancy, education, all to try and leave a better country for the generations to come. After all, I'm not standing here before you out of my own strength. I was immensely blessed to have a family of visionaries amidst a visionless society. I had the huge blessing of coming from grandparents who saw very little future for their kids in the family farm because subsistence agriculture was being taken over by, guess whom? The traditional oligarchs setting up monocultures of expert quality, sunshine yellow bananas. Even more so, I was immensely blessed to have parents who saw very few opportunities in my country and sacrificed so many financial things to give us, me and my siblings, the best possible education. I graduated with a class of 56 highly privileged students who had the opportunity of a bilingual education to pursue their dreams and goals abroad. Talk about privilege. Of those 56 students, over 30 are finishing their bachelor's degrees in the United States today. And I seriously keeps me up at night. It seriously keeps me up at night trying to count in my head all my friends from high school with which I can hope to rebuild a better country, a country where their children are not forced to leave. As for chapter 3 narrates the immense celebration that the Jewish people had whenever they came back from the exile in Babylon and they built their first temple. And I can only hope to see the immense jubilee with which my people will one day come after their long, long exile. And of course, my message is not, hey, give us our migrants back, let my people go. Of course not. Those who have made it here, who have struggled to learn the language, those who have stumbled to learn the culture, those who have sacrificed everything, those who serve to reap the benefits of their sacrifices, those who serve to give their children the chance that they don't have in my Honduras. No, I'm not calling for the expedited mass deportation of all Hondurans living in the United States to have the human material to build our country. All that I'm asking of you is that next time you see a first-generation immigrant, you thank them. Thank them not just for being here and working to build a better country out of the United States, but thank them even more so for leaving everything behind, for the courage and the bravery that it took to come here. Because one thing is for sure, that Abrahamic journey through the desert is no small feat. But please, please don't forget to also thank us, the ones left behind, the ones that don't quite look like this, all the leftover, the ones who are sometimes speckled, sometimes shriveled, sometimes brave, sometimes crazy, and are trying and dying to make our own place. I remember the very first banana I ever ate in the United States. I don't think I'll ever forget that. And now that I think about it, you know what it tasted like? It tasted like victory. And I only hope that one day my tiny Honduran bananas will fill with this exact same victory the stomachs of those who for so long have been too hungry. Thank you.
We're ready to listen to our third speaker, who is Kat Lehman. Her title is Diverse but United, Imperfect but Beautiful.
We live in a world full of conflict. Nations squabble over how to deal with terrorism, refugees, and other global concerns. Bickering occurs among political parties about issues such as immigration, gun control, and federal finances. And closer to home, members of the Mennonite Church argue how best to answer questions, such as the role of tradition in worship, or how LGBTQ individuals should fit into our vision for the church. It's a good thing the Bible doesn't forbid debate, for we often find ourselves in the midst of these issues, vehemently arguing one side or the other. However, my intent today isn't to explore any of these issues specifically. Instead, my goal is to convince you that as followers of Christ, we can't just wield our rhetoric with the reckless abandon of an impassioned argument, for this creates division and conflict. Rather, we should approach ideological differences within our church and community with intentionality, showing love and respect toward those with whom we disagree. Humans naturally tend toward divisive argument, but God challenges us to choose a third way. However, before we explore this third way thinking, let's acknowledge the root of our problem. Humans are hardwired to take sides. Studies show that we excel at identifying and socializing with others whose actions, appearances, and opinions mirror our own. Psychologists have demonstrated that babies as young as 6 months old show social preference toward individuals who are members of familiar groups, or even just others who like the same things they do. A study done by researchers at Yale University showed that infants consistently chose to interact with others who were similar in criteria as trivial as snack preference. So we're born with this tendency to choose sides, to categorize ourselves, and these behaviors don't go away. In fact, they become even more pronounced with age. As we develop, we continually back up our attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors by selectively exposing ourselves to evidence that supports our own views. And as we associate with others who are similar to ourselves, we tend to ostracize people who don't fit the molds we have forged, eliminating diversity until we have become immersed in racial, political, or theological conformity. This kind of behavior might be natural, but as you can imagine, it is not conducive to unity. Grouping together in this way quickly creates polarization. Polarization leads to a lack of empathy for the other side, and a lack of empathy for the other side results in the sort of banter so familiar to us all, where opposing sides face off in heated debates that don't really do much other than leave both parties feeling mutually cranky. As followers of Christ, we can't always assume that a way of thinking or behaving is okay just because it seems to be natural. The Bible makes that clear when it commands in Romans 12:2, "Do not conform to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." Therefore, it is clear that we cannot simply accept our natural tendencies toward divisiveness and exclusivity. How then are we called to transform our minds? Is it even possible? That is a big question, and it is one that has no simple answer. But after spending many hours puzzling over to how to begin transforming my own mind, I ultimately identified three goals for myself that I hope you might find useful as well. First, spend time with people who don't think like you do. All of us know people with whom we fundamentally disagree, or even just people who drive us nuts. We have to begin by identifying those individuals and making an extra effort to get to know them. Invite that person to do something fun. Buy them lunch or coffee, have them over for a movie, or to play a board game. If they agree to come, it will probably make both of you a little bit uncomfortable at first. But here's what I have experienced. When I go out of my way to spend time with someone who is different from myself, I inevitably find that that person I once thought of as them becomes a part of us. I have been amazed by how quickly and dramatically my mind is transformed through a gesture as simple as a cup of coffee. However, it is not just by chance that this renewing of the mind takes place. Intentional interaction forces people beyond their own exclusive groups, underscoring similarities among those who on the surface seem impossibly different. Studies show that decreasing in-group favoritism by identifying characteristics that we share with people who are different from ourselves significantly reduces bias. Furthermore, researchers have found that our bias is reduced not just toward those individuals with whom we interact, but also toward the groups to which those individuals belong. Secondly, we are called to refrain from selfishly correcting others. Many of us have experienced firsthand the kind of conflict and hostility that break out when we boss people around. I certainly have. Just ask either of my two younger sisters. But how then can we support each other within our church families? How do we promote constructive change? In his book, The Fellowship of Difference, Scott McKnight outlines a way that we can achieve this goal. He contends that love requires four elements: commitment, presence, advocacy, and direction, in that order. What this means is that if I want to give advice to my sister, I must first prove that I truly care about her. I do this by sacrificing time for her, showing compassion toward her, and establishing that I will continue to love her unconditionally. Only once I have demonstrated that my motives in giving her direction stem from my love for her and not out of my own selfishness or egoism can I effectively promote constructive change in her life. It is clear that Jesus knew this well. When he interacted with sinners, he didn't just tell them to go get themselves straightened out. He got to know them and help them with their physical and emotional needs before giving them advice. Jesus went out of his way to spend time with Zacchaeus, a cheating, despicable tax collector, before urging him to turn over a new leaf. He preached frequently to his disciples, but not until he had established that he did so out of a profound, unconditional love for them. Finally, as we spend time with people who think differently from us, we must maintain open minds. No matter how confident we are in the righteousness of our own ideas, we need to recognize that some of our beliefs are little more than glorified opinions. The Bible offers advice over a wide range of issues, but it isn't perfectly clear on everything. It doesn't tell us which political party is better, nor does it explicitly outline how we are to deal with every single controversy that arises in the church. Ultimately, the answers to these questions are never clear, and they require introspection, prayer, and discussion. However, this is all the more reason to branch beyond our bias-ridden groups and to engage in conversation with those who see the world differently than we do. Only after we can truly love those who are different from ourselves can we consider the answers to these difficult questions in light of everyone's needs, not just the needs of our own group. And once we are able to recognize those needs, we must also be willing to acknowledge the shortcomings of our own worldviews. We don't always have to compromise our convictions or pretend to agree with beliefs we think are misguided, but we should at least be as willing to receive direction as we are willing to give it. In order to experience the fullness and diversity of the church, we must identify the other we avoid, establish our unconditional love for them instead of trying to change them, and open our minds to the diversity of beliefs that prevail among all members of our church, nation, and globe, even if we ultimately don't agree with them. We can't afford to continue sequestering ourselves within groups of people who look, act, and think like we do. We can't keep drawing divisions among ourselves based upon what we believe. This world we live in is full of incredible diversity, but it's paradoxically tied together in the unity of God's unconditional love. As God's church, we are called to defend that unity, taking upon ourselves the challenge of loving and accepting all, even those with whom we don't agree. So let's strive to find commitment instead of conflict and common ground instead of competition. Let's work together to remain devoted to one another, even in disagreement. For we are called to be the body of Christ, diverse but united, imperfect but beautiful. Thank you.
We're ready to proceed with our fourth speaker. She's Hannah Mack Bull. Her title is, What is Your Intention?
2 months ago, I participated in STAR training with the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding, Strategies for Trauma Awareness and Resiliency. Towards the end of the week, a trainer asked for a volunteer to drive home a point she was trying to make. Eager to get out of my seat and move a bit after having spent way too much of the week sitting, I volunteered. She had me leave the room, gave instructions to the class, and invited me back into the space. Once up at the front of the room, she asked me to stand and face my fellow students with both arms raised perpendicular to my body. I was instructed to stand firmly. She would push down on my right arm, and when doing so, I was to resist her push. She did this several times. The first time, I stood strong. She was barely able to move my arm much at all. The second time, she pushed my arm down to my side almost instantly. It wasn't fatigue from standing firm the first time, because the third time, and several subsequent times, I was able to resist her touch. There were times that I could, and times that I could not. The same year I was born, 1994, Italian scientist Giacomo Rizzolatti produced one of modern neuroscience's most sensational discoveries, by accident. Rizzolatti, undertaking an entirely different study, happened to notice that as he picked up food pellets and placed them in a box, his study monkey, just sitting there, perched, watching him, was firing brain signals as if the monkey himself was the one moving the pellets. This happenstance is what led us to the modern discovery of mirror neurons, that I, at a neurological level, am mirroring you. Now, 23 years later, I stood in front of a classroom of over a dozen other students, and something within me was mirroring them. After our little experiment, the trainer let me in on the secret. Every time that she would push my arm, she would, behind my back, give either a thumbs up or a thumbs down to the rest of the room. This was their indication to think either positive thoughts or negative thoughts about me. The times that they sent quiet, positive thoughts my way, and maybe expressed them a bit in their body language too, were the times that I stood strong, resistant, and resilient to the trainer's touch. But the times that they sent bad vibes my way, I crumbled. I'm sharing this story with you now for more than the hopes that it will encourage you to think positive thoughts about me right now. I'm sharing because this was the first time I had heard of what I've come to wonder about as the phenomenology of trust, relationship, and reconciliation, the study of intentions. We mirror not only another person's movement, but her emotional state and intentions as well. But what does it mean to be a mirror? And what do our intentions have to do with trust, relationship, and reconciliation? Let me share two stories with you to illustrate this connection. A few months ago, I returned to the U.S. from Colombia, having spent just under a year learning and working alongside victims of the over 60-year armed conflict, and alongside the social workers and professionals that accompany them every day. The organization I was with works primarily with families forcibly displaced from the war, families with stories of the incredible violence that accompanies war. Every day, I saw the weight in the shoulders of the victims who had fled their homes and found themselves in our office. And I heard the comments of the social workers saying that this person lied and that person probably did too. I don't blame the social workers for wanting to make sure that the people who needed it most received the attention that they were able to offer. There were times I imagine they were right too. They had listened to clients tell their stories for years. But regardless, I wondered what it would look like if the social workers had been aware of their mirrors. When one of the social workers would relate to someone whose story they believed, whose story they trusted, they would stand in a grounded manner, they would speak compassionately, affectionately, and the client would often leave lighter, mirroring and embodying what they had seen in their caregiver. But when they would talk with someone whose story they did not believe, they would stand tense, they would talk firmly, and this too was mirrored. In reality, we could never know who walked those doors, having truly been displaced and victimized by the war. But what would have been different if the social workers had mirrored their radical compassion to everyone who walked through those doors? We are, after all, mirrors. At some point, I realized, or perhaps just remembered, that the problems of intentions and trust were not unique to where I found myself in Colombia. In fact, they were manifesting in my very own community in Harrisonburg, Virginia. On November 28, 2016, Eastern Mennonite University published its report of the investigation in response to allegations of sexual misconduct by the former vice president of enrollment and EMU's subsequent compliance with Title IX, the Clery Act, and other rules, regulations, policies, and procedures. The report, reflecting D. Stafford and Associates' independent investigation, found that Eastern Mennonite University held no responsibility in the case. It did not find any systemic failings, and it supposedly wrapped up a painful part of EMU's most recent history. I do not want to point, and I certainly do not want to place blame where it is not warranted, but I do want to ask, much like in Colombia, what parts of this process trusted the victims' narratives, and what parts did not? What were EMU's intentions, and how was this felt? In Colombia, the doubt and distrust were likely not tendencies of the individual social workers, but rather the effects of a violent 60-year war that had taught them to do just that. In one of John Paul Lederach's books, The Immoral Imagination, he references an old journal entry of his from his time working in Colombia, and he mentions the combination of pessimisms that float about the country. I found that the structural pessimisms there were what made caregivers doubt the very people they were trying to help. I have to wonder whether the investigation at EMU also showed the consequences of what we might call structural pessimisms. This report was not about people-to-people mirror, reflections, or explicit intentions. And maybe that is the point. Was the process undertaken with the DSA one that truly, fully trusted the painful narratives brought to the table? It respected process. It aimed to restore trust in the system. But what about the people? Did the process recognize our responsibility as individuals to be mirrors of radical compassion to those most hurt by the violence, despite what the systems were saying? What about our responsibility as Christians? Our responsibility as a Christian university? Our responsibility as a church not unfamiliar with the pain of sexual violence? I recognize a Jesus that came to contradict the powers that be, to bring hope to those affected by an oppressive system on top, and to remind us that power can come from the bottom. Divinity was the ability to stand with the masses, the marginalized, despite what the systems were saying. Franciscan priest Richard Rohr says that all divine power is shared power. There is no seeking of power over in the Trinity, but only power with. A giving away, a sharing, a letting go, and thus an infinity of trust and mutuality. So what do we do when we encounter systems that don't trust us? That is where we emerge with our intentions, to seek this infinity of trust. What happens when you place two mirrors face to face? Has anyone here ever stood between and seen the infinite expanse? That between is where we emerge with our intention to stand in the way. Black civil rights attorney and law professor Derek Bell invites us to do just this. He reminds us that service requires humility and the recognition that sometimes our actions are of more help to a system than to the victims of that system whom we are trying to help. He says, only with that realization can we seek change, quote, that is less likely to worsen conditions for those we are trying to help, and more likely to remind the powers that be that out there are persons like us who are determined, not only on their side, but determined to stand in their way, end quote. He calls for humility, a power with. Let us remind the powers that be that out there are persons like us who fully intend to stand in their way, in one of the most seemingly simple ways possible, by offering each other what the system often cannot, an infinity of trust and good intention. And it is only your good intention that will keep my arms up. Thank you.
We are going to hear from our fifth speaker now, Lydia Haggard. Her title is The Silent Treatment.
Every morning, I wake up with my cell phone blinking a little green light. I smile, knowing that it is a text from my friend. In the evenings, we text each other goodnight. But one morning, there was no light and no good morning text. Okay, no big deal. Maybe he slept past his alarm. I texted him good morning. No response for the whole day. I texted him good night. There was no response. The next morning, there was still no sign of him. Was he okay? I started wondering what could have happened to him. It was 3 days before I heard from him. He responded to my good morning with an unenthusiastic, "Hi." At this point, I was just glad to know that he was alive. He said he was fine, but I knew that he was not his normal self. After much questioning, I finally learned that he was mad at me and that I had caused him pain. I had no idea that I had hurt him. That was the time that my friend gave me the silent treatment. and I saw how destructive silence can be. Maybe some of you have experienced the silent treatment. I'm not sure why the term treatment is used. When I think of treatment, I usually think of a medicine that will cure and eradicate a disease. We have come up with the term silent treatment as if we are trying to fix something by not discussing it. When my friend refused to communicate, I could not fix anything because I didn't know why he was upset. Only when he told me what was wrong could I attempt to make it right. I needed him to talk to me so that our friendship could be repaired. Our whole country has been going through a silent treatment of not discussing important issues. By not talking about them, there is no room for healing, for naming the problem, and for moving forward in our relationships. I want to explore what it means to have a treatment to the silence instead of resorting to the silent treatment. The silence in the EMU community has been super obvious to me since November 9th, 2016. The day after the presidential election, I remember walking into class. I could feel the heavy silence in the room. My professor did a good job of addressing this silence. We all got in a circle, and we were free to share any thoughts we wanted to express. Some of us just listened, others felt heard, and were comforted to know that they were not alone in how they felt. It was one step in the journey of processing together. But I know that other classes did not have class-wide discussion. And since then, I can only think of two other safe spaces where I have felt free to speak and to listen about difficult topics. Why are we not talking about them more? In the case of the election, maybe people were not ready for it at that time. There was a time of shock for some, but now the surprise has worn off, and that is not an excuse anymore. We need to speak up about how we feel on all sides. The loudest speakers now are the ones who shake their heads more than they articulate what they do not like. The ones who applaud President Trump's actions may feel silenced and intimidated by the dominant liberal vibe here at EMU, or they may feel they have nothing to explain. Whatever the case may be, it is time to break the silence. Breaking the silence takes two parts, a speaker and a listener. Speaking can be intimidating if you don't know how the listener will respond or if they will even pay attention. Listening can be challenging because it takes humility to truly listen and not get defensive. It takes humility on both sides to speak honestly and to listen actively. Whenever you break something, you have to clean up afterwards. Breaking the silence is no different. There is risk involved that comes from being vulnerable and honest. People who speak out against the norms of society are often punished for it. Take Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., for example. In one of his most controversial speeches, A Time to Break Silence, Dr. King took a stand against America's participation in the Vietnam War. Some people say that this was the speech that Dr. King was killed. He was shot less than a year after breaking the silence about the injustices of the war. There are more recent examples of people taking risks while breaking the silence. In an article last month, the Washington Post reported that prominent American CEOs, including Tim Cook from Apple and Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook, are taking stands on new government policies, especially in response to the immigration ban. Because they are speaking up, they may lose customers who disagree with them. On the other hand, they may gain new customers. The businesses are expressing their viewpoints, even though it involves risk. But breaking the silence in a time of conflict is not unique to Dr. King or to modern day. In the history of the church, we see persecution attack the people who speak out against the traditions of faith. During the Reformation, the Anabaptist martyrs are an extreme example of people giving their lives because of what they believe and speak about. Macon Wenz is a famous Anabaptist martyr who was burned at the stake. Before she was executed, she was silenced by a screw holding her tongue so that she could not speak. Even today, religious persecution is happening. Speaking up is risky, but that is not an excuse to stay silent. The history of martyrs led to generations of silence among the Anabaptists. The Anabaptists in Germany became to be known as the quiet in the land. By not speaking about their faith, no one would have reason to persecute or condemn them. The people they lived with all agreed with each other, and they were safe. In American society today, it is much harder to remain untouched by the broader culture. EMU boasts in its diversity of student population. But if we are not sharing our opinions, the diversity of thought is lost. Nevertheless, the traditions of quietness seems to have infiltrated into EMU. Despite the dominant silence in our society today, there is hope. My friend finally told me how I had hurt him, and we were able to heal together, and we are still close friends. Other people have been speaking out in healthy ways about changes they want to see in society. The Women's March is an example of people choosing to make a statement instead of passively sitting at home. On EMU's campus, there have been small discussions, providing spaces to process the election, discuss racism, and talk about other challenges that are facing the country and the church. One especially helpful discussion I attended was the town hall organized by the Black Student Union. Faculty, students, and staff gathered to share their experiences and listen to each other about the concerns of others. These rich discussions are what I want to see expanded into our everyday conversations. Whether it is formally organized by clubs on campus or spontaneous conversations in the dining hall, difficult conversations need to expand into our daily lives. I would like to close with some thoughts about peace. We all know the familiar phrase, peace and quiet. We might say this when our baby sister is finally asleep, or when we sit on the EMU hill to watch the sunrise. But not all quiet is peaceful. In fact, quiet can be the way to hide the troubles and injustices in our community. Sometimes peace has to come through words. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was known for his gift of speaking out against injustice. He was also the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. Dr. King's act of speaking out led to peace. We cannot confuse silence with peace. Silence has to be broken by honest words for there to be peace. Writer Leonard Cohen has a quote that says, "There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." The treatment to silence is conversation. We need to break open the silence for light to illuminate the fears in our society. You have the ability to break the silence. Each of us must use that power to bring peace to the world. Thank you.
We're ready to continue with our sixth speaker. Our sixth speaker is Grantley Showalter. His title is Hygge and the Mennonite Moderate.
We are living in changing times. With the election of a new American president and rising political tensions, the Mennonite Church is again, a traditional peace church, is again faced with the question of determining what promoting peace will look like. We are confronted with a new set of circumstances and must respond to them while sustaining our tradition and our faith. What does it mean to be a peace church in 2017 America? This question must be answered. Through the course of this speech, I will focus on addressing struggles within the Mennonite Church, and I realize that not everyone here is Mennonite or attends a Mennonite church. In spite of this, my ideas and proposals are applicable to us all, regardless of religious tradition. Historically, the Mennonite Church has addressed the question of peacemaking one of two ways. The first option is to minimize interaction with the outside community and focus instead on building up our own as a witness to the outside world. This is often characterized by the term the quiet in the land, not disturbing the status quo in order to avoid getting involved in sticky situations. The second is a push to get beyond a place of comfort and safety and to reach out to oppressed people groups in our neighboring societies. This is often characterized by opening doors to the outside world for better or for worse. Each of these positions has a history in the Mennonite faith tradition. With the rise of social, environmental, and economic issues, exemplified by hashtag Black Lives Matter, protests at Standing Rock Indian Reservation, and the many marches that have been happening across the nation, the Mennonite Church is again faced with the dilemma of whether to get involved or to work towards an alternative. But before I tell you what I think the Mennonite Church should be doing, I'm going to present you with a word to shed some light on this conversation. Hygge. Hygge is a Danish word that does not have a direct English translation. Charlotte Higgins, a writer for The Guardian, asserts that, quote, though there are many ways to describe hygge, we see it as simply the Danish ritual of enjoying life's simple pleasures, family, friends, graciousness, end quote. Others describe hygge as the warm, cozy feeling of a log fireplace, a pair of warm socks, or a cup of hot tea. It is a sense or attribute of objects or locations that denotes comfortability, things that are familiar, and calm enjoyment. This may take the form of a childhood house, a cozy cafe, or a deep conversation with a close friend. Oxford Dictionaries listed hygge as one of the words of the year in 2016. Its rise to popularity is part of a growing enthusiasm around Scandinavian culture in parts of Europe and America. Hygge sounds like a positive thing and something worth striving for. While this is the case from one perspective, critics are quick to point out its weaknesses and limitations. Hygge is resistant to the new and does not like the unusual. It likes closeness with old friends, but resists getting to know new people. Some describe hygge as xenophobic. Its resistance to the unknown does not allow for change in opinion or challenge to past experience. It creates a zone of separation between it and the rest of the world. And most importantly, it is only possible for people of wealth and stability to achieve hygge. A disconnect between people in a position of power and people on the periphery springs into being. I am concerned that hygge is not as good as it originally sounded. The word hygge comes in handy when describing traditional Mennonite life. For example, Mennonites are known for their expertise in preparing food. If you've ever been to a Mennonite potluck, you would have undoubtedly encountered a sense of hygge. Mennonites also focus on the community of the church and work at fostering deep relationships among community members. Mennonite churches are often relatively small in congregation size, preferring to have many smaller churches rather than a few large churches. Even the meeting places of Mennonite congregations are often intentionally arranged to provide a sense of comfort and coziness. It is not a stretch to say that Mennonites are good at hygge. Celebrating our strengths is helpful and should happen. We must also look at how the criticisms of hygge apply to Mennonites as well. The Bible is crystal clear about its call to protect the weak and the needy. St. James defines the goal of his religion as an attempt to look after the widow and the orphan in their distress. This theme is repeated over and over again in both the Old and the New Testaments. God's call to the church is clear: protect those who have less power than you. Our society is full of power imbalances. Whole demographics are discriminated against on a daily basis. To understand some of this discrimination, we look to the field of economics, and we learn that actions always have externalities. Investopedia defines an economic externality as the side effect or consequence of an activity that affects other parties without being reflected in the cost of the good or service. They give the example of bees having the external effect of pollinating flowers while performing their main function of producing honey. In the same way, any decision that we make as the Mennonite Church will have an external effect on the community around us, especially those with little power. embracing a stance of huga may have positives for us, but it will have negative externalities. Too often, Mennonites have chosen the way of huga, of being comfortable, while neglecting the marginalized people groups in the same communities we live in. Martin Luther King Jr., the renowned civil rights leader, spent his life bringing together faith and the struggle against oppression. Mennonites often looked to him as a heroic peace warrior because of his nonviolent tactics. However, we often forget that he had strong words of criticism for the demographic that many of us find ourselves in. In the words of King, quote, "The Negro's great stumbling block in the stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but is the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice," end quote. He worked hard in his 1963 letter from the Birmingham jail to distinguish the type of peace being sought, saying that white moderates, quote, "prefer a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice," end quote. The Mennonite church must remember that King's term white moderate more often than not describes us, and therefore his criticisms apply to us as well. The Mennonite church has demonstrated as a whole what kind of peace it is looking for. Unfortunately, it is not the kind of peace that Dr. King dreamed of. Controversy over the question of including people on the LGBTQ spectrums has driven a wedge into the Mennonite church. Some strongly oppose inclusion and others strongly promote it. Many in the middle of the debate end up valuing a negative peace of going with the majority over standing up for the oppressed. The queer community has been callously trampled upon by arguments and discussions around this topic. For some of these people are my friends and have sustained much hurt by this white moderate. One friend told me that he knows the church does not know the pain they are inflicting. He knows that the negative peace that is being sought is not personally directed, but the reality of the rejection is clearly felt. Stories of sexual abuse coming from within the church and church institutions show that time and time again, the Mennonite church became the white moderate and overlooked the victim while trying to sustain what King would call a negative peace. The time for seeking comfortability, for being the quiet in the land, must come to an end. As I speak, First Nations people are beaten off their land. People of color are rejected from opportunities that white people take for granted. Sexual violence victims are silenced as they seek healing. Who is standing in their way? It's the Mennonite moderate. It's the white moderate. It's the Mennonite moderate who would rather stay comfortable, who would rather drink hot tea by the fire than listen to the cries of oppression coming from outside the window. A lifestyle of huga has become a trap, ensnaring the Mennonite church, and we must realize this. The gospel of God cannot be achieved through a negative peace, and Mennonites must wake up to our role in promoting oppression. Silence, by virtue of its externalities, is oppression.
Ready to hear speaker number 7. Our speaker is Joel Wheeler, and his title is "A Participation Trophy for Millennials: Why Millennials Don't Suck and Why Society Needs Their Participation."
College students, entitled, lazy, selfish, spoiled, naive, narcissistic. This is what our parents and grandparents' generations have to say about my generation. The millennial has been labeled quite negatively by those who have come before us. They say that we don't feel like we have to earn our way, that we don't have to work hard. They tell us that we've become absorbed into a world of social media and have created idols out of ourselves through status updates and posted selfies. They tell us that we do not know hardships and that we are soft. They presume that we are completely out of touch with reality. To put it bluntly, they say our generation sucks. And I'm not going to apologize for putting it any less eloquently. The reality is, this is what many people of older generations have to say about us. Okay, well, maybe my grandma wouldn't exactly tell me that I suck, but I have heard many people my parents' age say that very thing about us. We are told we are the worst generation yet, and it is a baseless statement. Sure, some of our parents may have bought us Game Boy Colors when we were tweens or put our faces on birthday cakes. They may have decided that everybody in the soccer league should get a participation trophy. But does this really mean that we are the worst generation yet? It is our parents' generation that has brought us an education system that has left Americans with over $1 trillion worth of student debt. A housing crisis so crippling, it led to the worst recession since the Great Depression. They started two wars that we should have never been in. And they kept 2.5 men on the air for 12 seasons. It seems to me, in contrast, that my generation is the most literate, most educated, and the most accomplished generation yet. And our lives aren't easy. We have to deal with the student debt, a 13% unemployment rate among young people, and overqualification as a result of our education. We have been brought into a country that is fiercely divided by politics, and that doesn't always embrace diversity and equality in race, religion, gender, and sexual orientation. We live in a country where young black men can't be sure that they won't be shot by a police officer when they get pulled over. We have found schools to be unsafe as we have watched too many elementary schools and universities devastated by school shootings. The purpose of this message is not to lay blame on our parents and grandparents, or to say that we millennials are the best. It seems like every generation before us, and every generation will, make their fair share of mistakes, and have wagged their fingers and aired their grievances about kids these days. For some reason, it's just really hard to watch your world change. My message is for my fellow millennials. We live in a broken world and in a country that we would all like to make a better place. And our society needs your participation and engagement now more than ever. Political activist and author Cornel West once said, "We need the courage to question the powers that be, the courage to be impatient with evil and patient with people, the courage to fight for social justice." Millennials need to get involved in politics and peace building. We can change the world, and we can do it our way. Many people in generations before us see the use of millennials on social media as narcissistic and vain, and that it can be. In addition, it has likely led to far too many selfies posted, hours of procrastination, and binge-watching way too much Netflix. However, social media has allowed us to communicate and to stay in touch with friends and family and share ideas faster and better than ever. And who could deny this? Who to this day is saying that the world is worse off because we have telephones, cars, and microwaves? Life has improved through this progress, through these innovations. And social media is no different. The Egyptian Revolution in 2011, for example, was a major social movement during the Arab Spring. It was organized by teenagers and young adults on Twitter. The Egyptian millennials called on their countrymen to stand up to the Mubarak regime and not accept the influx of police brutality and corruption in their country. Who knew that you could start a revolution in 150 characters or less? Social media is an excellent tool for political and social change. However, simply updating your status or sharing an article will not suffice. Facebook has been excellent and getting the word out about the Dakota Access Pipeline, for example. However, it was the people, young and old, who went out to the Dakotas to support our Native American brothers and sisters in protesting environmental injustice in a nonviolent yet non-relenting way that brought the issue all the way to the White House, where former President Obama put a stop on the pipeline construction. While a shared status or two on Facebook certainly helped raise awareness of the issue, it was the call to action that brought about social and political change. And many of you know that our new president has allowed the pipeline construction to resume. It is one item on a long list of things that are unjust in this country. We have seen the refugee turned away, equality for the LGBTQ community and women threatened and compromised. We have seen progress on awareness of sexual assault and hate crimes slide way backwards. Basic human rights like receiving a livable wage and having access to affordable health care may not be something that our government supports in the future. Climate change reform has been completely thrown out the window, so perhaps we will have no world to live in at all someday. Many millennials are discouraged by our political system. They feel like their vote doesn't really count and that they have no voice. But you do have a voice. You just have to speak up. And get out and vote, for crying out loud. While we have a steady upward trend of young people coming out to vote each election, we only had half of eligible voting millennials come out to vote this past election. And I would guess that more than half of millennials are complaining about the results of the election on social media. So that's just unacceptable, and we can do better than that. Some will say that we are snowflakes for speaking out or taking action. It's easy for people of privilege to think that we should just accept things the way they are. That's probably what they would have told young college kids who formed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to participate in sit-ins during the Civil Rights Movement. They probably told those spoiled, overeducated punks that black people and white people aren't meant to mix, so they should be segregated and not be served in certain restaurants and not be allowed to use the same drinking fountains and restrooms as whites or be educated in the same schools. Those young people didn't listen to this, and they stood up for what was right. They took spit in their faces, punches to their stomachs, and horrible racial slurs to heart, yet they stood firm and made their voices heard. We live in a broken world indeed, and many see the future as bleak. Admittedly, it would be easy for a white middle-class male like myself, a person of privilege, to just tune out. It would be easy for people like me to just sit tight and share the occasional Facebook article to make themselves feel progressive. However, it is our call from Christ to stand up for the disenfranchised and actually get active in building peace and calling for justice. In Matthew 25:35, Jesus says, "For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. For I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was sick and you took care of me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was in prison and you visited me. Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me." When we see our neighbors hurted and discriminated against, we should be good citizens and stand with them. Martin Niemöller, a Protestant pastor who publicly spoke out against Hitler, famously said, "First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one to speak for me." We're in this together, guys, and we can make the world a better place. Have you ever been sitting in history class and thought to yourself, while learning about slavery or the Holocaust, and thought to yourself, what would I have done? Would I have done the right thing? Would I have been on the right side of history? Well, history is being written right now. So whatever you're doing is what you would have done. So get active and speak out. Share those articles on Facebook. Get out and vote for the love of God and love your neighbor with the love of God. We are the future, so let's make it brighter. Thank you, and peace be with all of you.